In 2020, 20% of U.S. adults received mental health treatment, with 16% of those peeps taking prescription meds. This is up from 2019 data, and the data just keeps getting worse. One in five U.S. adults experiences a mental illness each and every year. One in 20 has a serious mental illness each year. One in six youths aged 6 to 17 experience a mental health disorder every single year. And suicide has become the second leading cause of death among people aged 10 to 34. During the pandemic alone, one in 15 U.S. adults experienced a substance use disorder and mental illness, and 12 million adults had the thoughts of a suicide. One in five peeps said that the pandemic had a significant negative impact on their mental health. My guest today is Dr. Joseph Yee. He is a certified addiction psychiatrist in Newtown, Pennsylvania, who helps his clients to move from mental illness to mental wellness. This is The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open, and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus. You'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark.
Dr. Joseph Yee is a board-certified addiction psychiatrist based in Newtown, Pennsylvania. He has been in practice for over 17 years and has helped thousands of people in his community get off prescription medications, and he empowers his clients to become the CEOs of their own health destiny through more integrative approaches to mental wellness. He is the founder of Modern Behavioral, Beyond Recovery, and his Instagram has over 200,000 followers. His purpose and mission has been to help individuals all around the world focus on mental wellness instead of mental illness. Dr. Joseph Yee, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Hello, Lindsay. It's an honor to finally meet you.
I know. Finally, we have been following each other on social media for a while now, and instantly I was like, oh, we're going to have some things to talk about. So you are a holistic psychiatrist, and the amount of mental illness that exists in the United States is, it's frankly alarming. We're talking one in five U.S. adults having some kind of mental illness challenge each year. We're having one in 20 having something serious. One in six U.S. youths between ages 6 to 17 have experienced a mental health disorder. And the lifetime rate of mental illness, 50%. Of people before the age of 14 and 75% by the age of 24. And the pandemic has made it, the numbers just explode. And we're recording, listeners, today on July the 27th. And just this week, another paper comes out that says use of antidepressant medications worsens depression over time. And it's just like we feel like our backs are against a wall. And so, you know, your story is powerful. So why don't we start, just tell us a little bit about what got you to this point.
What started off was all the wrong reasons. So for the people who support my Instagram, who they probably heard the song, the story, God knows how many times, but I grew up really poor in Philadelphia. My parents were dry cleaners, and you know, we were so poor to the point where, you know, we couldn't afford heat during the winter times. I don't know if you lived in a condition like that, but that sucks, you know? And one day I just woke up and I said, you know what, man, I want to make a lot of money. I want to become somebody. A lot of people were like picking on me at school. So I said, if I have like status, if I have some money, if I became somebody, all my problems will be resolved. And so that was the motivation. Pain fueled me to want to become a doctor. And that's, it will motivate you. But once you get into medical school, and you start taking like gross anatomy and histology and biochemistry and all this stuff, you know, you don't want to do any of it. And you, when you lack purpose and a very strong reason to do something, What ends up happening is you start failing and you get kicked out of school. And I pursued a career in music for about 3 years. And I really try to make it as like a techno DJ, kind of like rock pop star. And at the time, I thought I was talented. In hindsight, kind of lacked certain skills. But I did a lot of drugs, Lindsay. I did a lot of drugs at the time. I partied a lot. But at the same time, I learned how to be more socially intelligent and connecting with other cool people. Like a lot of rock stars and musicians are just cool people. That make probably some poor choices with the kind of stuff that they want to put into their body. And I was one of those guys. So after 3 years of putting all these toxic chemicals that were a lot of fun in the beginning, after about 3 years of that, I just got so sick physically and mentally. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired and broke. So I just had this one moment where I was like puking because I was smoking too much weed and I didn't have enough to eat. And I puked all over my shoes. I remember a bunch of these college kids were like walking by and saying, "Hey man, you homeless douchebag, why don't you clean up after yourself and make something of yourself? Get out of here, loser." And then that was like the moment where I said, okay, this music thing isn't working out. I got to do something. Aha, how about I go into psychiatry and or addiction medicine, because I have this drug problem right now and I'm depressed as hell, you know? So first, let me figure out a way to overcome this experience with depression and this substance addiction. And I detoxed myself. I started working out, like eating right, sleeping right, you know, doing all the basic things for mental wellness. I got myself back into medical school and now I had purpose, you know, had a very strong reason why I want to become a psychiatrist and focus on addictions work. So that's kind of like how I got here. And for the people who follow my social media who are like, "Hey, how do you like know how to edit videos and stuff?" Like, well, that's all from my music days. And it's amazing how at the time when I was doing music, I was like, "I curse you, God. I'm a good person. Why am I struggling so much? This life sucks. Why am I going through all this?" But that was what allowed me to get the PhD in compassion and being able to connect with other people who are struggling. So that's how I got here. And now I'm meeting you and the good people watching this.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm interested because, you know, my listeners, you have probably heard this story. I thought I wanted to be a psychiatric pharmacist until I worked in psychiatry, in pharmacy school. And I just was not built for it. I was so not built for it. Like everybody just like sucked the life right out of me. And I remember one time really distinctly, I had a patient who had schizophrenia and she got admitted like the first couple of days of my rotation. She was inpatient for almost 3 weeks, like really trying to stabilize her, get her back out the door, get her meds tuned up, all the things. And she comes back and bounces back 2 weeks later with another schizophrenic psychotic break. And she doesn't know me. She doesn't remember me in any way, shape, or form. And at that point, I was like, this is not the industry for me. Like, I am not built for this. And what I increasingly realized, one of the reasons I'm not built for it is because the meds simply don't work that well. And they cause huge, astronomical amounts of side effects. It's horrifying, really, when you get down to it. I mean, nobody warns you that taking clozapine is going to put 30 pounds on you, or Paxil is going to put 20 pounds on you and kill your libido and kill your motivation. And, you know, so I would love to hear more about what is your understanding about how psychiatry is changing to have more of this holistic approach. Because, you know, you're not the first psychiatrist. Dr. Ellen Vora was just on here the other day and we were talking about how addictive antidepressants are and nobody's talking about it. So what is holistic psychiatry?
Well, before I get into that, real quick, you touched on something really important. With these psychiatric medications, I just want the listeners to know, and I don't have clinical evidence on this other than just from my experience of seeing my patients going through it. You know, like the books will teach you certain things, but I like to listen to people and their experiences more than what the books say.
Amen.
for the people reading, listening to this, watching this, the three most difficult psychiatric, like the serotonin reuptake inhibitor, kind of like that class, the three most difficult to get off of are Zoloft, Paxil, and Effexor. So, which is the SNRI, it works a little bit differently. So, you know, if you guys are on it and if you want to get off it at some point, because I don't think anyone goes into see a psychiatrist saying, hey, I want to get prescribed an anxiety medication for life. You know, mm-hmm. like they all have this notion that they're going to be on it for a certain amount of time, help them with their situation, and then they could get off it and move forward, right? But when someone's on a high dose of medication for an extended period of time, then it just gets hard to come off of. So this is just a warning, a friendly warning from my clinical experience of working with clients, that those three medications, Paxil, Effexor, and Zoloft, have been very, very, very difficult to come off of. So, you know, like if someone offers you Prozac and you feel like you might want to take it, you do what you need to do. I'm not going to stop you, but just be mindful of that, because that's something that doctors don't really educate their patients about the how difficult it is to come off of these meds once you have a different life experience. So having established that, a holistic psychiatrist is someone who looks at the body, the mind and body as a whole. You know, I just think it's so weird how if someone comes into the office and says, I have depression, and they say, oh, well, have you tried Cymbalta? Yeah, I did. And it didn't really do much for me. Okay, well, then there's Prestique available now. what if I'm depressed because, you know, I found out my dog passed away, or my wife has been hanging out with someone else behind my back. Yeah. You know, that's a whole nother reason and a whole nother pathway of treating and healing. The issue that I'm having with psychiatry right now is they're only looking at it from one angle. There's an article that came out recently that serotonin is not the reason for depression.
You don't say. Okay. Yes. Continue. No, of course it's not. Of course it's not.
Yeah. So as a holistic psychiatrist, like for me, I like to keep this super simple, and just like with marketing, right? Just like a simple message is the best message. And I encourage people to focus on the four pillars of mental wellness. Very simple. Focus on sleeping right, eating right, exercising right, which comprises of the mind and body, and connecting with the right people. And start off with that. And I would say 90% plus of the people, if they really put their energy and focus and love towards those four pillars, they'll be feeling a lot better. They won't need to see a psychiatrist like me. But if you're doing that and you're trying to do all the right things and you're still struggling, sure, maybe some medications could be helpful for some people sometimes. However, you nailed it on the head just before too, in that the hope for psychiatrists and doctors, I don't think these people are bad people, except for maybe Fauci. But generally speaking, I believe that doctors have good intentions. And the hope is that the combination of some of these medications, like a depression medication, an anxiety medication, can help people feel better, like this synergistically. But what people fail to recognize is that these side effects, these chemicals, you're putting toxins in your body every single day. It's a poison. If you take enough of certain pills, you can die. You're not going to OD by eating too many mangoes. At least I don't think so. So there's a difference between a nutrient and a chemical that you're putting into your body. And when they accumulate over time, what happens is people start feeling all these other side effects, like you mentioned. And that's a whole nother story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a whole nother story, because the side effects, you know, medications, they have effects. It's just some of them we like and some of them we don't. And the ones that we don't are what we call side effects of the meds. And, you know, you think about the classes of medications that are the most commonly used in psychiatry. You know, we have our antidepressants, the SSRIs and SNRIs, and then there are all the typical antipsychotics, the atypical antipsychotics, and then you have all these like weird, like the valproates of the world that we're kind of like, how do they work? We don't exactly know. Same thing with like topiramate, like how it we don't exactly know. But then there's the sedatives and all the benzos that can be so addicting. And I think what also rapidly becomes dangerous in psychiatry is the multipler effect, where one med didn't work, and so we just add another one. And now we've got side effect burdens of two medications, and we're spiraling down and not towards the solution of how do we sleep better, eat better, move better, and have better connections with others. And so if people are listening and they're like, Lindsay, your show is a broken record. All you ever tell people is to sleep better, eat better, move better, connect better, and don't stress out. Like, that's literally the whole show in a nutshell. But change is hard. Change is really hard, especially for someone who is deep in the throes of like a super anhedonia where you just don't want to do anything, or somebody that's like, whose brain has been so scattered for so many years. You know, how do you encourage people to start?
Yeah. So unfortunately or fortunately, like when someone's in the comfort zone, nothing really happens. And I call that the death zone. You know, it's just like you're basically withering away. You're not really growing in any way. And it's a horrible place to be. So, you know, people, I truly believe that people change from my experience working with a lot of like people with addiction histories. They change through either inspiration or desperation. Either they're inspired by like love. Hey, I just, I'm using crack cocaine and I'm using heroin. I'm using whatever. And I just fell in love with this woman and I want to become a better version of myself because I saw her Instagram profile and she seems to date all these healthy dudes. So let me try to get healthier so I could fall in love with her and have her fall in love with me. That happens probably about 20% of the time, but 80% plus of the time, I would say, is more people having been in a really desperate situation where they have no other options but to change. People will change when they have to. And, you know, I think parents, I'm a parent and I have two kids and I love them to death. And we all do. But sometimes they love their kids to death where they don't really allow the kids to face the challenges and allow them an opportunity to grow and learn from their mistakes, which everyone listening to this knows this by now. But I said this all the time, time after time after time again. And then, you know, I had a patient recently who basically was using multiple substances, ran a red light, almost killed a bunch of people. And the reward for that, the parents bought her a new car. Now, why would any parent do that? Because she totaled that car. And of course, she has to get to school. And we want to say, hey, look, we forgive you. Like, these kind of things happen. You got to learn your lesson. But we're going to buy you a new car as a show of like that we love you. And I get that. But, you know, your kid's never going to grow without suffering or at least facing the consequences of their misbehavior. And that's the basic principles of operant conditioning, where if changes to occur, you should be rewarded for good behavior. But there should be some sort of a consequence for misbehavior, or else that misbehavior is constantly going to be perpetuated throughout the kid's life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, this is something that we learn in Al-Anon is we don't take steps to prevent consequences that are in the natural course of someone's bad behavior. And so if you are surrounded by someone who is an addict, like, you don't take the step to, like, you know, I mean, yeah, you try to keep them from driving drunk, but you don't take the step to, like, force them not to go to the liquor store. And you don't take, like, sorry, these are the consequences that are a natural result of the behavior that you continue to display that you know is bad behavior. And, you know, you don't prevent it. And yeah, I can't even imagine, like, you know, you total a car, you almost kill somebody, and then you get a new car. It's like, you could have walked for like 6 months, you know, you could have
taken the bus.
Yeah, or ridden a bike or anything.
But I'm a big fan of consequences, but also I think it's important for parents to recognize, like, when a child or their teenage adolescent needs help. You know, and the main way to differentiate that is, like, is the kid trying? You know, if the kid keeps messing up, keeps relapsing, but, like, you could, you know, in your soul that the person is trying, then they need help, you know. But if they just don't give a crap and they keep doing whatever and flicking the birdie to their parents and just doing their thing, there must be a consequence. I've never witnessed anyone changing without one of those two ways happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so, you know, you've talked about we've talked a lot about substance addiction, but one of the things that you're seeing a lot on the rise of is technology addiction. And it's honestly one of the things that I, as a podcast host, if I find myself like drifting, because I do post videos of like people on it, but then it's like, I instantly stop myself. I'm like, you can't scroll. You have to listen right now. And we've lost the art of listening and genuine human connection because of technology. And so what are you seeing as trends in technology addiction?
Oh my God, Lindsay. I really believe that TikTok kind of messed up a lot of things, because these 8-second, 15-second videos are so addicting that I like making 1-minute content. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, I know I've seen some of your things where you're doing some of the shorter form contents as well. It's almost like you kind of have to do that now to even get any sort of engagement, because these 8-second videos are so addicting. They're kind of funny. They teach you something really quick. So I think TikTok set the trend for now Instagram and all these other platforms to try to like make YouTube shorts now too. It's getting shorter and shorter and shorter. So I see that as a big problem, as evidenced by the Surgeon General came out, I think almost a little less than a year ago, saying that emergency room visits for suicide attempts rose 51% over the past year for adolescent girls in 2021. And he had some bizarre reason, like it could be because of racial injustice, climate change. I don't think these kids are trying to kill themselves because of climate change, at least not yet. Right. But one of the things that he did say that I do believe I agree with is increased loneliness. And isn't that crazy? They're like, we're connecting with, like, I wouldn't have been able to connect with you and the great people watching this without technology. But isn't that amazing for people? Like, they're reporting an increased sense of loneliness despite all this connection through technology. But the concern is that when you have increased, think about it, during the whole pandemic situation over the past 2 years, this what were people doing? They're glued to their phone trying to figure out what the hell's going on. They're getting one side of the story. Let me check out someone else to see what they're saying. Okay, so increased screen time, which leads to, I think for these girls, especially for these adolescent girls, increased like fear of missing out. They see their friends hanging out at these parties. They see their friends having a great time, looking happy, going on vacation. So they feel like they're not enough. So that's like one of the primers for them feeling like garbage. And then increasing screen time, which the average teenager nowadays is averaging about 7.5 hours a day screen time. That's most of the time when they're awake, you know, it's a lot of time. And that displaces your ability to engage in activities that are vital for your mind, body, wellness, such as like sleeping right. We of course know, like with the blue light, it's going to affect your melatonin production. So you're not sleeping right. That instantly affects your mood. You're not really, why would you want to go out and exercise when you could get the same dopamine fix by watching an 8-second video
of someone else exercising?
Oh yeah. I've seen you dancing plenty of times.
Oh yeah.
And it limits the person's ability to be motivated for interpersonal engagement in real life, when they're kind of connecting with people online and they could write a comment or text each other and so on. So then I'm seeing like a spike in anxiety in these young guns, because they don't really know how to socialize anymore. And I'm not saying for everybody, but you know, don't you find it hard to limit technology even for yourself? It's getting harder and harder. Like everything that you and I do and the people watching this are doing, we could do everything through our phone pretty much. So it's been hard for me too. I'm fully guilty of like sometimes my screen time going up to like 8-9 hours. I'm like, oh my God, like I'm trying to warn people and I'm on the screen this much. So it is a constant effort, just like in recovery. Like you have to be in active recovery. Just because you stop using a drug doesn't mean the journey's over. Like now you have to engage in active recovery.
Yeah.
For technology addiction, I would encourage everyone here to be active and mindful in terms of how much time they're spending. Obviously you can't fully get it down to like zero if you have work and so on, but just be mindful of that and try to set some goals, weekly goals, as to where you want your time limit to be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of my friends who is in recovery, and she's been sober a really long time, she always reminds people, like her sponsees and stuff, that you don't graduate from addiction recovery. Like you don't graduate from AA. You never are done. Like it's something that you must continually do. And so Another thing that really irks me about how conventional psychiatry treats anxiety, depression in addicts specifically is you throw an antidepressant at the problem, you throw a drug at the problem, but unfortunately, because alcohol is what it is, these peeps are so amino acid deficient, they're so B12 deficient, like so just deficient in minerals, you don't even have a fighting chance to even build enough serotonin to sit in the synapse. And so I talk to people till I'm blue in the face because they're like, I'm taking this antidepressant and it's not working. And I was like, did anybody recommend that you might need some amino acids? And they're like, never heard that in my entire life. And I'm just like, why is medicine so broken? Before we get to the rest of my interview, let's take a break for a word from our sponsors. Your microbiome is a collection of fungus, bacteria, and viruses that live on you and in you. And the gut alone contains more than 100 trillion microbes, with as many as 5,000 different species. And there are multiple other microbiome sites, including the skin, the mouth, and the vagina. Imbalance in our microbiome can cause intestinal disorders like inflammatory bowel disease, IBS, celiac disease, and extra intestinal disorders like allergies, asthma, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, obesity, chronic fatigue, and it increases the risk for anxiety and depression. The bad news is that probiotic supplementation simply might not be enough to prevent disease. We know that we have to take different steps to mitigate stressors as well as other toxins that are poisoning our microbiome. We need to completely overhaul our diet. We need to understand the relationship between the gut, brain, skin, lungs, and heart. We need to know how different microbiome systems throughout the body interact with one another. I invite you to the Engineering Your Microbiome Summit. It is free and online and happening right now. Do not wait to get signed up. Head to lindseyelmore.com/microbiome to join for free. Because once the content is gone, it's gone. And you will miss out on interviews with more than 40 experts talking about everything from how to engineer your microbiome to heal small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, how the microbiome can help with pesticide detox, how it can help to heal trauma, how gluten is destroying your microbiome, how parasites, Lyme disease, all of these things are relating to your microbiome. Join today. It's free and online, but only until October 2nd. And now, let's get back to the show. And so talk to us about your supplement line, why you chose the ingredients that you did, what are the products designed to do, all of that.
Yeah. And wow, this is a very interesting topic because, Lindsay, I don't know what kind of experience you had in PharmD school, but in medical school, I would say there were less than 5% on anything about nutrition. About eating smarts.
Right.
And the one class that we had, it was called Biochemistry of Nutrition. And we were taught to memorize what a triglyceride fat molecule looks like memorizing that chain. Do you want to try to teach me what kind of fats would be healthy to eat to optimize my brain power? That would be more important. You would care about that. The people listening to this would care about that. Yeah. They don't care about if I know the structure of a triglyceride molecule, but that's the kind of nonsense that we were taught.
Oh my God, we were taught so much nonsense that I'm just like, do I really need to dissect the brachial plexus to be a good pharmacist? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a heart surgeon over here, you know? So anyways, you never know. I could go back to school. I've been so mad so many times that there have been just time after time after time that I've thought to go back to medical school and just try to like change the system. But then I'm just like, why?
Well, you're creating an impact through your podcast and your social media channels and so on. But for the viewers and the listeners here, just think about it. Prozac is a very common antidepressant medication. And the way it's supposed to work is it slows down the breakdown or the recycling, reuptake of serotonin. Where does serotonin come from? It doesn't magically just appear. There's not mm-hmm. a single molecule of serotonin in Prozac. It comes from the foods that you eat.
Mm-hmm. And your gut.
We, of course, know that tryptophan is an amino acid found in like turkey and other health foods, such as like pineapple, nuts and seeds, pumpkin seeds especially. And tryptophan converts to serotonin. First converts to 5-HTP, which then converts to serotonin. And in the absence of light, it converts to melatonin. So yeah, it comes from the foods that you eat. Adderall, like we have a lot of parents who allow their kids to be prescribed Adderall, a stimulant, a speed really for their kids' attention deficit issues.
It's literally one methyl group away from methamphetamine.
A woman. And basically what does Adderall do? There's not a single molecule of dopamine in there. All Adderall does is it goes into your brain, does something, and triggers the release of dopamine. But where does dopamine and norepinephrine and endorphins, all these things come from? It comes from the foods that you eat. And specifically for dopamine production, you need to eat foods that are rich in tyrosine, which are found in like bananas, dark chocolate, nuts and seeds, beans, meats and poultry. And for serotonin, you need tryptophan. So at a certain point after I graduated from residency and I'm just like prescribing people medications and, you know, helping people detox off of medications too, using certain comfort meds, and they just feel like garbage. And eventually I came to realize like their serotonin system has been manipulated. Their dopamine system has been manipulated. It's almost like now they're dry of dopamine if you're constantly falsely triggering, manipulating the release of dopamine. Mm-hmm. So I started doing some research and I found out that, hey, if I give people tyrosine as a supplement, an amino acid that converts to dopamine and norepinephrine eventually, and I could grease it up with cofactors like a good B complex and magnesium and some zinc, it could really optimize the production of dopamine along with like a healthy gut biome too. And I was recommending a lot of other supplement brands to my clients. And after a certain point, I was like, you know what? How about I just, instead of asking people to buy 8 bottles of all these different cocktails to optimize their dopamine production, why don't I just create my own supplement all-in-one kind of package? So that's kind of how the idea for Beyond Recovery started. And we have different products to help optimize neurotransmitter formations, help with mood, help with anxiety, so on. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, I'm not allowed to say that it could help out with depression or anxiety because—
Of course not.
So I'm not making those claims.
Why would you ever think that? I mean, no supplement can do that.
Absolutely not. But it's definitely something to help support your mental wellness journey.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So, you know, to add on to what you said, Adderall is one of those drugs that it just so rapidly depletes all of these neurotransmitters. And that's where the addiction starts to come in, where you become so addicted to it, where you have the dependence, the withdrawal, and because you simply don't have any dopamine or any serotonin to give, that's where the escalating dosage becomes very important to get the similar effects that you once had. I mean, I have seen Adderall doses in children that scared the daylights out of me. I mean, I told one parent they were picking up a prescription and they wanted me to fill it. And I was just like, 80 milligrams of Adderall, 80. I'm like, this kid is 12 years old. I finally just asked the mom, like, have you ever taken 80 milligrams of Adderall in one day? And she was like, no, this is my child's prescription. And I was sitting there in my mind and I was like, if you took that much Adderall, you would never give that to your child again, because you would feel the heart racing, the dry mouth, the increase in blood pressure, the insomnia. And another thing about Adderall is just because you can focus doesn't mean that you're focused on the right thing. You could be focused on Instagram or on video games or TikTok or whatever. And, you know, I had my year of Adderall when I was in undergrad. And by the end of the year, I was just like, look, do I like feeling hyper? And do I like feeling like that drive? Yes. But do I hate the consequences of that so much? And I was just like, I'm done. I'm done with this drug. I'm not doing this.
You know, whether you take Adderall or methamphetamines of any sort, cocaine, it's almost like you're borrowing energy from the future. It all comes from somewhere. And then so the next day after you go on an Adderall binge or a cocaine binge, you just feel really tired and blah and unmotivated. Like, but you sacrifice that for yesterday's, you know, attention and focus. So this goes on. And I would love for the viewers and listeners to visualize it this way. Like, imagine if you have like a balloon of dopamine. Adderall comes and puts pressure on that balloon to pop it and trigger the release of dopamine and norepinephrine. But if you keep doing that, you're going to be depleted, like you said, of dopamine and norepinephrine. So unless you eat right, or if you don't have the time to eat all these healthy foods, at least supplement right to replenish the dopamine, then your dopamine levels are always going to be low. So the Adderall is not going to work. It will put pressure on the brain to trigger the release of more dopamine and norepinephrine. But if you don't have it, what do doctors do? Let's raise the dose. Then you're putting more pressure to try to squeeze out more dopamine from there. And that's how that kid got to 80 milligrams a day. It would make a lot more sense, Lindsay, if you replenish the dopamine. And if you're going to choose Adderall routes, at least replenish it with nutrients that could help optimize dopamine and norepinephrine production.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, whenever I do podcasts or social media content where you basically talk about how bad medications are, number one, I get pushback from people saying, you know, the antidepressants saved my life. And I'm like, great, more power to you. You know, that's awesome. But another question and another like really assertive comment that I get on the regular is, by you teaching people that these medications are generally ineffective and moderately dangerous, you are creating risky behaviors for people discontinuing their medications without the help of their prescriber. And so I'm not doing that. I'm not telling you to go home and quit all of your medications, especially because many of these medications are addictive, even if they're not even classified as controlled substances. People become dependent on antidepressants. And so if somebody is listening today and they're like, all right, doc, I'm ready to do my sleep. I'm going to get up in the morning. I'm going to work on my circadian rhythms. I'm going to get better connections. I'm going to cut toxic people out of my life. And now I want to eliminate my multi-drug protocol that I am on. How do people begin to get off of medications?
Yeah, and to start off with this, I would like to say that I do believe that some medications can be helpful for some people sometimes. But what I'm finding out is a lot of times when people are on a psychiatric medication, like they find it to be very helpful, even like Adderall, like, wow, it really helps improve my mood and my focus and my motivation. But then after a couple months of that, you develop a tolerance, you run out of dopamine, and like the side effects build up and it's just not the same thing anymore. Same thing for like these antidepressants. I see this time and time again, where it could help out for a certain time period, but afterwards, like they just develop a tolerance to it and they're just taking it to not withdraw from it, not experience discontinuation syndrome, which is a fancy word for withdrawal. Mm-hmm. So what I would love for the viewers to keep in mind is that how difficult it is to come off of a drug. Because people will say, hey, is it true that Zoloft is harder to come off than Paxil? Well, it depends. It depends on three factors from my clinical experience, which is how high of a dose you're taking is one factor. And for how long have you been taking that? And based on that, that will determine how difficult or how painful or uncomfortable it would be to come off of it. A third factor, which I really don't have, again, any scientific evidence for this, other than from my experience, is that women seem to tolerate psychiatric medication tapers much, much, much better than men. And I believe that that's why women are allowed to have babies and guys can't handle that. Mm-hmm. So I have had so much more success with women than men. But having established that, you know, the slow and steady wins the race. So many times people say like, I can't believe that I got suckered into taking these meds, and they blame their doctors, they blame themselves. And that's just a complete waste of energy. Just, okay. So if you're basically in a better place in your life and you want to come off these meds, there's no, it's not about how you started it or who started it. It's how you finish that counts. And there's nothing wrong with just taking it slow and easy. You know, sometimes it could take years for someone to come off of a benzodiazepine medication or Zoloft, for example. But numbers wise, it's very important that people understand this concept. If you're on 100 milligrams of a medication, and you know, usually I'll start off by saying, how about we drop 10% and let's just see how you feel after that. So you come down 10 milligrams to 90, okay? And they usually are like, hey, you know what? I feel okay. That's okay. I can move forward in this. And so now they start developing a little bit of belief and confidence within themselves that they can do this, right? But the issue arises when, say you're down to about like, this is an extreme example, but say you're down to about 20 milligrams and you come down another 10 milligrams, that's now a 50% drop. That's a completely different story. So when you're getting lower and lower on a drug, every drop becomes a greater percentage, and it could really affect your mood more or the withdrawal symptoms more. So people have to be very careful because they start getting too confident, too cocky, and they're saying, oh, I could do this by myself. And then they start tapering themselves, but the percentages get bigger as they're tapering at the same milligram dosage. So towards the end, it gets a little bit tricky. And Lindsay, you know, as a doctor of pharmacy, you know, sometimes they don't make medications at certain lower doses. So you got to get creative in finding like a compounding pharmacy that could take that Paxil dose and break it down into like a 1.5 milligram dose so that you could take that and step away from that little by little.
Yeah. And you'd have to have a really good scale, you know, because most of these meds are capsules, and that is just such a manipulation for the American people. Cause you know, tablets, it's a lot easier to say, take a half a tablet or even a quarter of a tablet. But yeah, when you're having to break up capsules and average, you know, doses, it's complex. And yeah, you're not going to find a 1.25 milligram Paxil. It just doesn't exist. You can find a 20 milligram, but that may be about it. And, you know, and the whole thing of that you mentioned earlier, the take more med, escalating dosages, just trying to squeeze the bubble when there's nothing actually even in the bubble. It so reminds me of how we got to the opiate epidemic. I mean, Purdue Pharma was so flagrant and so blatant in their marketing about just double the dose from 10 to 20 to 40 to 80. And the FDA didn't step in and try to stop them until they were about to launch a 160 milligram dose of OxyContin. And, you know, this whole dose escalation, part of it is because we're coming back full circle from where we started. These meds are not natural. They are synthetic. They are xenobiotics. They are foreign biological substances in our body. And our body is very well skilled at saying, I want to get rid of foreign substances from my body. And so your microbiome actually shifts and changes and morphs to become more effective metabolizers of these xenobiotics, which is, again, just escalating the dosages, increasing the risk of addiction, increasing the risk of it being very difficult to come off. It really, really is just so broken. The whole system is broken.
And as a result of that, Lindsay, we of course know that fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid, is now the number one killer in young Americans between 18 to 45. I mean, that's double the rate of suicide since 2020, tripled the amount of COVID deaths. And fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that's estimated to be anywhere from 30 to 50 times more powerful than heroin. Back in the day, people, you know, I live in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. There's not too much to the heroin scene, like compared to like Philadelphia or some of the inner cities. I'm in like kind of like farmland area. So people are like relapsing on alcohol and like prescription pain meds. not so much like these fentanyl, but fentanyl abuse is on the rise. And I think within the past year, the U.S. surpassed 100,000 drug overdose, 100,000 drug overdose deaths, and for the first time in U.S. history. And it's estimated, some people believe like 65 to 75% of that is from fentanyl OD. So it's a serious problem that's happening. And I think it's very important for people. And a lot of the fentanyl is coming. I don't know if you know or are aware of this, but the ingredients that they use to create fentanyl is coming from China. And U.S. blocked China from getting these chemicals into our country. But there are other ways around it. They sell it to Mexico, and then through Mexico, they cross the border, and so on. Sure. So these things are getting in, and a lot of people are, it's escalating at a rapid rate. And the new drug that's around in Philadelphia that I want people to know about is a drug called Trank. It's a combination of fentanyl plus xylazine, which is like a clonidine. Do you know that drug, clonidine?
I do. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like a blood pressure medication that has sedating effects. But xylazine is an analog of clonidine, but made for like horses and bigger animals to tranquilize them. So that combination is killing a lot of people. So that's on the rise. And my concern is that going to be spreading to other communities? And people could say, well, you know, my kids aren't into that. They smoke weed. And I know people that buy some, you know, Xanax off the streets and that kind of stuff. But the issue is now, my concern is that fentanyl traces have been growing throughout the country in terms of like finding it on street drugs. So, you know, people got to be careful. Like you and I can't stop people from wanting to buy Xanax off the street or buy a little Adderall, so on. But just be careful that it could be laced with fentanyl, and just a little crumb of fentanyl is enough to kill somebody.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So when I was in pharmacy school, one of my jobs was to do the reconciliations for the anesthesiologists at the end of the day. So, you know, the anesthesiologist would pick up a box in the morning, they'd bring it back to me in the afternoon, and we would reconcile their case records with how much drug that they were returning to me. Fentanyl is so dangerous because it is dosed in the micrograms. It is a very tiny amount. Like, it's honestly, as a student pharmacist, like, it took me a while to get my confidence that I was doing the math right, because you look at morphine doses and you're talking 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams. You know, you're talking like easy to remember numbers. When you're talking like 125 mics over here, 250 mics over there, you know, 300 mics here, another 80 mics here, the math just gets very complicated. Because, I mean, I'm not calling myself dumb, but dealing with three digits is harder than two or one. You know what I mean? And so I remember when we thought Dilaudid was dangerous, because Dilaudid is six times more potent than morphine. And I mean, you make a mistake with a Dilaudid dose and you think you're given a morphine dose, that person will die. And the pharmacists in some of these communities, pharmacists, we got to stop judging the addict. Because if you're dispensing the OxyContin out of your pharmacy, there are so many pharmacists that refuse to fill Narcan. And it's just like, what are you talking about? Like, don't even play the holier-than-thou card with me. If you are willing to dispense medications known to be deadly with a quick and rapid reversal agent that, when administered timely, will save someone's life, you must dispense both. You must dispense both.
That's a great point.
Yes, you cannot do that.
But Lindsay, you know what's crazy about some of these new synthetic combo drugs like Trank, the combination of fentanyl and xylazine, is that Narcan doesn't work for it.
Oh, great. So good. So this is what my addiction pharmacist who trained me in pharmacy school, we would sometimes have people on so much med and such long acting meds. So, cause I trained in San Francisco, so we had a huge methadone problem. Well, the more methadone you take, the longer it takes to get out of your system. We would have to put people on Narcan IV drips to keep them awake.
Really?
Really? Really. And I mean, you live in San Francisco, you learn a lot about heroin addiction, opioid addiction, because you would have to find out, you would almost have to drill down to the level of their dealer to know what exactly you were working with, because a bag of black tar heroin versus white crystalline heroin, it's two completely different patients.
Lindsay, being a doctor of pharmacy, if I may ask you a quick question here.
Sure.
I know we're kind of running out of time, but do you see from your experience, is there any reason that you could think of why fentanyl should be legal at this point?
Well, don't even get me started on sufentanil and remifentanil and all of like the Me Too fentanyls that are even more potent and more concentrated. And like the
I'm asking an honest question here. I mean, yeah. there's oxycodone, there's dilaudid, there are other opioid pain medications out there. Like, what is, why is, if it's killing so many people,
right?
And people are abusing it and so on, why is it still legal? And why are they coming after and N-acetylcysteine, which is one of the products from BeyondRecovery.com.
I mean, oh my gosh, on, the N-acetylcysteine. I okay, in all honesty, if I were to put on my white coat and be asked this on rounds, why fentanyl? It's because fentanyl acts so quickly and wears off so quickly. And that's great if you're an anesthesiologist doing a knee surgery. You can't put a patient under with oxycodone or OxyContin. And so that wearing on and wearing off effect is very, very beneficial around the perioperative time. It's just like cocaine. People think cocaine is a class one narcotic. It's not. It's class two narcotic because it is so effective when used in nasal and eye surgeries because it works very fast and wears off very fast. The problem with drugs that work very fast and wear off very fast is that they are the most addictive. They are the most addictive because the cycle of withdrawal happens so quickly. This is why we typically don't see Halcyon used anymore. We see Ativan and Klonopin and Xanax and longer acting benzos because Halcyon, also a Sackler family brainchild, was so addictive when it first came out. So, you know, that I think is the reason why, is because of the fast on and fast off. But that said, how many years did we survive with just morphine IV and dilaudid IVs before the fentanyl ever came out? You know, it's...
Yeah, exactly. Do the pros outweigh the potential cons of someone dying from this being out there? And, you know, just my frustration sometimes is, why are they coming after nutrients?
No, I know. You don't.
I actually heard that they might be coming after curcumin. I'm like, are you serious, Matt? Curcumin?
Yeah, you're gonna take away a vegetable. Okay. All right. That's cute. That's so great. Oh my gosh. Well, Dr. Joseph Yee, it has been such a great, great time chatting with you. If you head to lindsayelmore.com/Dr. Yee, that's DRYI, you will get a link to top 10 mental wellness supplements. That is a free PDF that you can download. And if you head to beyondrecovery.com and shop the promo code STREETMD, you will get 11% off of all of the Beyond Recovery supplements. And last but not least, if you would like to know more about Dr. Yee's practice as a psychiatrist, head to www.modernbehavioral.com. That's www.modernbehavioral.com. Joseph, it's been such an honor and privilege to talk to you today on the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Miss Lindsay, the honor was mine. So nice to finally meet you and having the opportunity to vibe with the great people watching this. So thank you so much.
If you have been struggling with poor immune system functioning, gastrointestinal issues like bloating and constipation and gas, or maybe even something as bad as celiac disease, Crohn's disease, or ulcerative colitis. Maybe you just have these skin flares of acne and eczema that come out of nowhere. Allergies, hay fever, maybe even just brain fog and chronic fatigue and insomnia, or maybe even vitamin and mineral deficiencies. You may be feeling the effects of a microbiome dysbiosis. Dysbiosis is when our microbiome, the germs, bacteria, viruses, parasites, as well as yeasts and fungus that are living on us and in us, become disrupted. We disrupt our microbiome by lacking nutrients and fiber in our diet, lack of exercise, not getting enough sleep, having too much anxiety, the use of many medications and antibiotics, prolonged time spent indoors in contact with man-made materials and surfaces disrupts our microbiome. And if we've had a recent infection from pathogenic microbes, that can also turn into a disruption in our microbiome. Genetic factors, as well as overexposure to toxic household cleaning products, agricultural pesticides and herbicides, and cosmetic products not designed with your microbiome in mind, can lead to all manner of symptoms. That's why I decided to host the Engineering the Microbiome Summit from September 26th until October the 2nd. You can tune in live and for free to the Engineering Your Microbiome Summit, where I have interviews with more than 40 industry experts. We're talking physicians, nurses, chiropractors, nutritionists, all that help us to engineer a healthy microbiome that can prevent and reverse both physical and mental illness. Head to lindseyelmore.com/microbiome to save the date and get signed up for the Engineering Your Microbiome Summit. That's lindseyelmore.com/microbiome to sign up today. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support the Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindseyelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag @LindsayElmoreShow and help us bring the pod to more people.